must have remained in her mind as she tolerated more and more stays from visitors over the years, even after she and my father divorced. One of our visitors, Sharif, my father's elderly uncle who resembled an African red fox, had decided to grace us with his presence for several weeks. I was 14 at the time, and my parents and siblings were gone for some inexplicable reason. Maybe I had stayed home from school, who knows? All I know is that I found myself alone with this man, who had to be in his 70s, but was still in good enough form to do some jumping jacks if he needed to. His French was broken, and often unintelligible, and so was my Wolof, so our language barrier was pretty prominent. When he called me for my snack searching in the kitchen to where he lay stretched out on the couch, lazy and entitled, like the Senegalese version of Jabba the Hutt, I knew I'd be in for a struggle. The request started out simple enough. He indicated his hands and asked me in a French Wolof hybrid, "Ana coupe? Coupe?" Literally, "Where's cut?" "Cut?" It took me a minute, but all I had to do was look at his nails to understand his request. "Ah, les coupes d'ongles? Je vais les chercher." I pointed behind me and pronounced it again, louder, as if my volume would magically make him understand. "Cherchez." So I went to find the nail clippers, which I knew my mother kept in some cluttered drawer of her bathroom. As I thoroughly searched each drawer, I crossed my fingers that we had all been responsible and considerate enough to have put them back where we found them. I shuffled through tampons and cotton balls and nail polish and eureka! I jogged back to the family room and handed them to him. He nodded with mild appreciation as he took them from me. I went back to my dad's office to internet surf. 10 minutes later, my surfing was interrupted. "Issa!" Had I heard my name? I waited. Maybe he was coughing. "Issa!" Nope, not a cough. I scooted away from my leisurely act of nothingness and made my way back to the family room. Sharif handed me the clippers, and as I nodded, readying to put them back, he stopped me. "Hara, hara." I turned back to see him pointing, this time at his feet. I looked down at the long nailed toes he wiggled, and he continued to say something in Wolof that I didn't want to understand. I tried to hand the nail clippers back to him and was met instead with a closed fist and a single finger pointing in my direction. "Me?" I played dumb. "Qu'est-ce que tu veux?" More Wolof from him, then the word coupe, as he made room for me on the couch, flexing his feet and pointing his toes. I couldn't believe this mess. I didn't know what to do. I knew what I didn't want to do, but if I refused, would that be a grave sign of disrespect? Would I cause some family drama between him and my father, or a confrontation of some sort? On the other hand, if I did do it, wouldn't I be disrespecting myself? Why did I have to be the only one home today? Why did this jerk feel so comfortable asking me to perform this task? At 14, did I look like someone who did man feet? Why couldn't I have been one of those roughneck Latina girls I went to high school with, who constantly disrespected authority figures without any remorse? I ain't doing dick. Fuck your toes. I was far too polite, and I hated that about myself. I didn't even know where to start. So without touching his feet, I slowly started with the big toe. His feet weren't completely ugly, which I appreciated, but neither were they nice looking enough to change my perspective on the matter. Clip. I looked at Sharif, who checked his toe. I guess that was good enough for him. He lay back and allowed me to continue. On to the next. Clip. Clip. I felt my dignity and pride chip away with each nail that dropped to the towel he'd set below his feet. By the time I got to the fourth toe, which was kind of small, I tried to position the nail clipper just over the nail without putting his skin in the danger zone, and again without putting my hands on his feet. I could feel Sharif tense up, which made my hands shake out of nervousness and insecurity, which was enough for him to hold his hand up and say, "Ça va, ça va." We both exhaled as I gave him the clippers, and he finished the rest of the job himself. I didn't know what was worse, being asked to cut his toenails in the first place, or being stopped because I wasn't doing a good enough job. Fortunately, all of our other house guests were far more considerate. Sure, we'd be relegated to sleeping in the living room as our beds were given away. But that inconvenience was mostly left to Lamin, who had his own room. Elise and I shared a room. Many of our guests would cook up delicious Senegalese food, give us rides to places we needed to go, including school, and do the chores we didn't want to do. Dishes. Up until my high school trip back to Dakar, practicing French with our guests by way of pleasant conversation and eating chabougine and yassa was enough to make me feel like I was still in touch with my culture. But within the first day of my visit, I realized how wrong I was and how much I'd been missing out on. First and foremost, camaraderie with my family. One thing that had remained constant since we lived there when I was very young was the family house, the structure of which was unlike any other house I had ever seen, much less lived in. It resembled a single-story motel in that there was a courtyard terrace with rooms surrounding it. The pathway at the entrance of the house led to an outdoor center terrace, off of which was a kitchen on the right and then the family room. Most of our quality time was spent in one of two rooms, the family/living room, which held the youthful portraits of my grandparents, and my Tante de Fatu's room, which held one of the bigger televisions in the house and a VCR. We came with suitcases bearing many gifts, piled on by some of our aunts back in Los Angeles for their children, and medicine for my grandfather. But I'd say the most coveted item we held was a compilation of music videos I had recorded over the course of a week before we arrived. Before international internet, American music hits didn't come to Senegal until 6 months to a year later. What I held in my hand was pop culture currency and the opportunity for my cousins to be ahead of the curve in their social circles. We must have watched those music videos every other day that summer, emulating the dances of Nelly and the St. Lunatics, learning all the lyrics to Ray J and Lil' Kim's Wait a Minute, and rewatching the same Freestyle Friday battle on AJ and Free's 106 in Park. Later, I'd find out that none of the songs I had recorded would be huge hits in the United States. So much for my A&R career. But they were mega hits around the house. It was perhaps during one of these bored bouts of rewatching music videos that I expressed a desire to go out and do something fun. "Do you want to go to the club?" my cousin Pop Amadou asked. Footnote, yes, I have a brother named Amadou and about 10 cousins named Amadou. My grandfather's name is also Amadou. I have a brother named Malik and I have about 10 cousins named Malik. Both names are like the equivalent of John and James, respectively. The club? Did they know I was only 15? "I'm only 15, I suggested. Pomadou, who was 17, shrugged. "That doesn't matter. You can get into the clubs at 16 here. They don't care." I had yet another brief moment of panic as I considered my inability to dance. But then I realized I was among family. Plus, the club would probably be playing mostly Senegalese music anyway, and I wasn't expected to know how to do those moves. "Nyani plays really good rap and R&B," he added. "Oh. Well, still, I was among family, and why not?" "Let's go," I exclaimed. We took two cabs to Nyani. Pomadou rode with some of his neighborhood guy friends in one cab, and I rode with Skinny Dawa and my older cousin Hadi in another cab. I had dressed up in my Nike Prestos, shoes that were the envy of all my guy cousins, blue jeans that I had rolled up to the ankle, a red tank top, and a red bandana that blew in the wind as I sat in the back seat by the window. I looked like I was auditioning to be a jet in West Side Story, but I thought I was cute. We got inside the club at around 10 o'clock, and it was nearly empty. As we took seats at one of the many vacant booths, DJ Eduardo played a song by a Brit named Craig David that I had never heard before, Walking Away. Craig David had released only one song in the United States that I'd heard, called Fill Me In. The Senegalese were way more familiar with him than we were. I bobbed to the song as I took it all in, the fancily lit dance floor and the adult ambiance that made up the decor. By the time 11:30 hit, the club started to fill up with teens and adults in their 20s alike. My cousins and I hit the dance floor with Pomadou busting the big pimpin' dance at every opportunity. I was enjoying myself immensely, dancing in a way that felt comfortable, which consisted mostly of upper body and hand movements. I was mid-hand dance when I caught the eye of a tall, dark, handsomely thuggish, ruggish bone-looking guy who was watching me dance. I looked away and continued dancing near Daawa, who by then expressed that she was ready to sit down with Hadi, who at 26 was acting closer to 46. I told her to go have a seat without me, as I was still dancing with Pomadu and his friends. I looked back at Thuggish Ruggish, who continued to look my way, and smiled. Now confident that he was actually looking at me, I smiled, nodded back, then turned away and waited. As I started feeling the music and myself a little bit more, I turned back to see a shorter, darker, nicely dressed but not who I was looking for gentleman come my way, smiling. He started dancing in front of me, mimicking my dance moves, making them look way cooler. I smiled, impressed, and we continued to dance as I looked around for Thuggish Ruggish, who had disappeared. Dance Chameleon saw me looking around and whisper screamed into my ear, "Denga Wolof." "Non, mais je parle français." I saw his expression reflect slight disappointment before he smiled again. "Je m'appelle Moïse, et toi?" "Joissa," I said, introducing myself. We continued to dance in silence as DMX Rough Riders came on and we both started singing along. He whisper screamed again, "I love the way you dance. A man after my heart." "Thank you." He continued, "You remind me of Missy Elliott." I tried not to stop dancing and restrained myself from showing offense. I'm sure he meant it as a compliment, but he immediately made me think my sleek, sexy dance moves instead look like large, bouncy hops. In a move that sparked my deja vu, he asked if I wanted to go outside. I looked around and made eye contact with my cousins to tell them where I was going. Outside, he introduced me to some of his friends, all of whom were dressed in FUBU, Rockaware, Aniche, Fat Farm, all the cool brands my mother refused to buy us at home. One of his friends, Carrère, was the tall, thuggish, ruggish I had been eyeing earlier. As we grew closer, Moïse would later reveal to me that he thought I was looking at him the entire time. I never denied it. Carrère and I shook hands for far too long, as I realized that I was far too nice to ditch Moïse now. The summer I fell back in love with Senegal is also the summer where I fell in love for the first time. I wasn't looking for Moïse or even checking for him initially, but it was through him that I re-envisioned my heritage through eyes I'd never opened before. He gave me my first uninhibited Dakar experience and taught me so much about what it meant to be Senegalese. I returned to Los Angeles with a new appreciation for who I was and from where I had come. I felt culturally validated and significant in a whole new, confident way. That summer made me realize why my parents, and my mother especially, made sure to abide by the customs and traditions that my father had introduced to her. And I was certain that I would do the same for my children, and the children who come after me. My parents were absolutely pleased with my new appreciation for my family and my country, until they discovered that I had run up our international phone bill by over $1,000 in just 1 month. If only I had the good sense to develop a program akin to Skype. Maybe Dad was right and a computer science degree would have come in handy. Fashion deficient. Some lack common sense. My grandfather lacked two of his five senses, taste and smell. And I lack fashion sense. One needn't feel sorry for me. I was born this way, so it's not as if I knew what I was missing. My ailment was pointed out to me by others, some of whom dropped subtle hints. Still others were too disgusted to even bother. I was never fazed by it until my social life was affected. For a brief period in middle school, TJ Maxx saved me from complete pariahdom. The day my mother took my youngest brother and me there to buy spring clothes, I thought I had found a secret designer loophole for how I might improve a certain look. "Do people know about this place?" I wondered aloud. It was a stupid question considering the hangers and markdown clothes left in disarray everywhere around the store. Tons of people knew about TJ Maxx, but none were as grateful for it as I. My introduction to the Los Angeles fashion scene wasn't friendly by any means. Within the first few weeks of moving from Maryland and meeting my first LA friend, Ashley, I committed my first fashion faux pas, and it was a dangerous one. My idea of good fashion was matching. If my shirt matched my bottoms, and I had a hair scrunchie and maybe shoes that all matched in some way, I was obviously killing the game. In my younger days, if my average outfit was a paint-by-numbers game, it would consist of 1 to 2 numbers maximum. Solid colors were my best friend, so when Ashley invited me to hang out at her house one crisp